It is Monday, February the 5th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, Israel granting legal status to previously unauthorized outpost in the occupied West Bank.
What we've seen throughout the West Bank and East Jerusalem, and as well as the area around Nablus, is that even where there is privately owned Palestinian land, the Israeli government will seize it, supposedly for security reasons.
Also ahead, classified Russia probe memo released, China reacting to the U.S. nuclear posture review, plus some sad news from the world of music. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Israel has granted legal status to a previously unauthorized outpost that's in the occupied West Bank near the town of Nablus in response to a Palestinian shooting attack last month that left a rabbi dead. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the decision was meant to allow the continuation of normal life there. Palestinian officials condemned the move and said it seemed to be the result of President Trump recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, breaking with decades of U.S. policy. VOA's Victor Beatty speaks now with the University of San Francisco Middle East scholar Stephen Zunis for some insight into all of this.
All Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian territory seized by Israel in 1967 are illegal. According to international law, the Fourth Geneva Convention forbids any occupying power from colonizing territories seized by military force with civilians, and its application to the West Bank and as well as East Jerusalem has been confirmed by no less than five UN Security Council resolutions and a 2004 ruling of the International Court of Justice. This particular settlement, though, due to its location and further surrounding the major Palestinian city, was deemed too provocative even for the right-wing Israeli government, or it had been until this latest decision. Of course, the murder of the rabbi and all acts of terrorism, of course, are illegal, even if somebody is taking part in a illegal settlement, and the killing of civilians is never legitimate, both legally and morally.
Well, there appears to be some speculation as to whether or not the authorization of this making it legal would proceed, as parts of the outpost may have been moved elsewhere if found to have been built on private Palestinian land. So this is not necessarily a done deal.
That's very possible. But what we've seen throughout the West Bank and East Jerusalem, and as well as the area around Nablus, where I've actually visited fairly recently, is that even where there is privately owned Palestinian land, the Israeli government will seize it, supposedly for security reasons. The Israeli army will move in for a short period of time, and then they would turn it over to a settlement. And so we've seen this pattern elsewhere. So this may be what we will end up seeing in this case as well, even if it is deemed to have been on private Palestinian land.
What is the trajectory or the future of the West Bank, in your view?
It's very discouraging, frankly. There are many people who, for years, have advocated a two-state solution, who are coming to the conclusion that it may already be too late, and we need to start talking about some kind of single binational state. And again, it is the moderate to liberal Zionist who dominated Israeli politics in the early days of that country's existence, who are most disturbed at this trend. They see the rise of the right-wing ultranationalism of the Israeli government in the way that many liberal and moderates see the rise of Trump here in the United States and some of the right-wing nationalist parties in Europe as distorting many of the values that their country supposedly stands for.
Does the Netanyahu government still garner widespread support?
Israeli politics has definitely moved to the right over the years. both as the high hopes for a peace settlement back in the 1990s have lessened. The fact that the more conservative ultra-religious elements have tended to have larger families, and that can change the demographic of a small country fairly easily, quickly. And that many of the more moderate to liberal voices have felt silence, and in fact, many have emigrated, seeing their country as being very different than it was in their youth. So it does appear that these kind of politics do have a surprisingly high degree of support, and this is very different than the more idealistic view that many of us. Here in the United States, ahead of Israel, those of us at least who are old enough to remember Israel in its earlier days. At the same time, the level of corruption around Prime Minister Netanyahu, and perhaps including Netanyahu himself, and the investigations that are going underway, along with differences within this coalition, could mean that. We could have elections in the not-too-distant future, and perhaps a more moderate government could emerge.
Stephen Zunis is a professor at the University of San Francisco and an international relations scholar. He specializes in Middle Eastern politics plus more. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. Here in Washington, congressional Republicans released a classified memo related to the Russia investigation after President Trump decided that document should be available to the general public. The memo from Republican members of the House Intelligence Committee alleges that U.S. law enforcement officials, including the FBI, abused their authority in seeking to put a Trump campaign associate under surveillance for possible ties to Russia. The release of that memo on Friday has set off a political firestorm over the Russia probe here in Washington, as we hear now from VOA national correspondent Jim Malone.
President Trump agreed to declassify the Republican memo over the objections of both the Justice Department and the FBI. Trump said in a tweet that allegations in the memo showed that top law enforcement officials politicized the Russia probe. He later spoke to reporters at the White House.
But I think it's a disgrace what's happening in our country. And when you look at that and you see that and so many other things, what's going on, a lot of people should be ashamed of themselves and much worse than that.
The Republican memo alleges that the decision to put Trump campaign associate Carter Page under surveillance was largely based on information gathered by a source funded by Democrats. For their part, Democrats condemned the release of the memo and said Republicans had selected certain facts in a bid to help the president and undermine the Russia probe led by special counsel Robert Mueller.
The point was to selectively declassify information so that it would support a narrative favorable to the president.
Throughout his presidency, Trump has complained the Russia probe is a witch hunt. And the president and his Republican allies in Congress were eager to see the memo released, says analyst John Hudak.
Republicans are absolutely trying to undermine the Mueller investigation. They see this as not only a serious threat to the president, but they see this as a serious threat to the Republican brand, as the president and the Republican brand are intertwined.
Democrats also warned Trump not to use the memo as grounds to fire Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, who is overseeing the Mueller probe, or perhaps even Mueller himself. That could set off a constitutional crisis, says Thomas Schwartz.
As much as I think he may not like Mueller and not like Mueller's efforts to investigate him, I think firing him now would be a real problem.
But conservative analysts like Michael Barone say Democrats may be overplaying their hand.
I think that there's obviously some people, most of them in the Democratic Party, that think, this is going to be another Watergate. They're going to get the smoking gun. President Trump will be out of there, out of the White House in 6 weeks, 2 months, whatever. In my judgment, that's unlikely to happen.
Some Democrats have compared the Russia probe involving Trump to the Watergate scandal that engulfed President Richard Nixon in the 1970s. Nixon ordered the firing of the special prosecutor investigating his White House in 1973, but he resigned the following year after Congress began impeachment proceedings. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Leadership in Beijing has just criticized a U.S. government report that labels China as a potential nuclear adversary and called on Washington to reduce its own nuclear arsenal. The U.S. military, in its 2018 Nuclear Posture Review, outlines Washington's plans for updating its current U.S. arsenal, nuclear arsenal. VOA Asia's Ira Melman speaks now with Alexandra Bell. She's Senior Policy Director of the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. She says she's not surprised by China's reaction to the posture review.
It is a document that is giving the impression that the United States is pushing to increase the size and the role of nuclear weapons in our national security strategy. And it would stand to reason that China would see that as a potential threat. China has long maintained what we refer to as a minimal deterrent force of just under 300 nuclear weapons, only about 100 of which could reach the United States. The United States, on the other hand, has about 4,000 nuclear weapons in its active nuclear stockpile. So there's a very large difference between the nuclear arsenals of China and the United States.
So is China trying to lessen the tension here or just level criticism?
I believe China wanted to make it clear that it found this nuclear posture review to be problematic. At the same time, China is engaged in a nuclear modernization program of its own. It's adding new types of nuclear capabilities. It's moving towards potentially putting multiple warheads on missiles, something that it's often referred to as MIRVing. And also, it has allowed the international community to start debating whether or not China was actually committed to a no-first-use policy, the idea that they would never use nuclear weapons first. Now, I'm glad to see that the Chinese officially reaffirmed their commitment to this policy, but the question is, why was it ever under debate in the first place?
Overall, how does the Pentagon report differ from past reports?
The last one was in 2010 under President Obama, and this nuclear posture review, unfortunately, is a move away from the previous report insofar as it, again, is pushing to increase the size and the role of nuclear weapons, really breaking with decades-long precedent of bipartisan support for reducing the role of nuclear weapons and moving away from an increased global arsenal.
What about world opinion? After this report has come out, are more countries perhaps siding with China? What are some of the, we've already heard reactions from Russia, I do believe, and worldwide, what do you hear?
I imagine that the world is concerned about this move by the Trump administration. It is no secret that people have been concerned about some of the rhetoric that President Trump himself has used when talking about nuclear weapons, and in particular, the types of aggressive comments he's made towards North Korea and specifically to Kim Jong-un. So I don't imagine this is going to make people feel better. At the same time, again, China and Russia and other nuclear weapon states like India and Pakistan have been investing in the modernization and potential expansion of their nuclear forces. All nuclear weapon states are playing a role in increasing nuclear threats right now, unfortunately. Just in general, if China is concerned about the Trump administration's nuclear posture review, it should engage the United States. It should be talking to the United States and, in fact, all nuclear weapon states about strategic stability, about where we should be going in our efforts to reduce nuclear threats, to stop proliferation. And there are items like the ratification of the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty that, you know, there's nothing stopping the Chinese government from moving forward with ratification of that treaty. Indeed, it would be a signal that China wants to lead global efforts in reducing nuclear threats, and it would put pressure on the United States to follow suit.
Alexandra Bell, Senior Policy Director at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation, she was speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. North Korea's ceremonial leader Kim Jong-nam will be visiting South Korea this week as Seoul boosts hopes for high-level inter-Korean talks during the Winter Olympics that begin in just 4 days. We asked Tufts University Korea scholar Sun-Yun Lee if this move by North Korea is significant.
It's very significant for North Korea because Kim Jong-nam's visit to South Korea is part of North Korea's campaign to mesmerize the South Korean public into believing that North Korea means well and to advance its leverage vis-a-vis South Korea and the United States to get its adversaries to gradually de-escalate, back off, and relax prematurely, that is, sanctions against North Korea, and to buy time with which to perfect its WMD, Weapons of Mass Destruction program. So North Korea is showing its sincerity, in quotation marks, by sending Kim Jong-nam to South Korea, by sending out the message that we mean well and we are sending a very high-ranking official, so don't criticize us.
Meantime, President Trump said during a meeting at the White House with North Korean defectors that despite a very tricky situation, North Korea's participation in the Olympics could result in what he called something good. Also in the news, U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said the U.S. is considering restricting the sale of Venezuelan oil in an attempt to pressure that country. During a visit to Argentina, Mr. Tillerson said that during his meeting with the country's leaders, he had raised the possibility of oil sanctions as a way to ensure free, fair, and verifiable elections in Venezuela. But Mr. Tillerson also said he wants to find ways to mitigate the negative effects sanctions would have on U.S. oil companies, as well as Venezuelans and other regional countries that rely on Venezuelan oil. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new vaccine therapy developed by Stanford University researchers may someday provide hope for cancer patients. Working with mice, the scientists injected minute doses of two vaccines they created directly into solid tumors that had developed in the animals. Stanford University Professor of Oncology, Dr. Ronald Levy, MD, is the senior author of a study that outlines the research team's findings. According to the study, this vaccine can treat many different types of cancer. Dr. Levy says the two-part vaccine treatment stimulates the immune cells only within the tumor itself, but the researchers observed effects that included the elimination of tumors all over the animal. A human clinical trial to test the effect on the treatment in lymphoma patients began in January. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Well, we have some sad news from the world of music. One of the emperors of soul is dead. Dennis Edwards died in the U.S. city of Chicago at the age of 74, and after going there not long ago to recuperate from a stroke.
It was the 3rd of September, That day I'll always remember. Yes, I will. 'Cause there was the day that my daddy died. I never got a chance to see him. Never heard nothing but bad things about him. Mama, I'm depending on you to tell me the truth. Mama just hung her head and said, son, Papa was a rolling stone. Wherever he laid his hat was his home.
Dennis Edwards was the lead singer of The Temptations, an American vocal group which released a series of very successful singles and albums during the 1960s and the 1970s. Joining the Temptations, Edwards sang with the Contours, which opened for the Temptations in the late 1960s, and when the Temptations' lead singer, David Ruffin, left the group in 1968, Edwards was asked to take over to record songs like Papa Was a Rolling Stone and their super Grammy-winning hit, Cloud Nine.
See, I was born and raised in the slums, that's all. There was a one-room shack except another chair beside me. We hardly had enough food or room. It was hard time. I needed some relief, my trouble land. Grandfather didn't know the meaning of work. He disrespected mama, treated her like dirt. I left home to get a job that I never did find. Depressing time.
Edwards left the Temptations in 1977 to pursue a solo career, but rejoined the group some years later. In 1989, he was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, along with five members from the Temptations' mid-1960s heyday.
Let me tell you about Cloud Nine. You can be what you want to be. You ain't got no responsibility.
Dennis Edwards' marriage to Ruth Pointer, one of the Pointer sisters, ended in divorce. He's survived by his wife, Brenda, with whom he lived in St. Louis, Missouri, five daughters, a son, and a host of grandchildren. Edwards was always at his best behind a microphone, whether in the recording studio or on the stage, like when he sang lead in the 1969 Temptations hit, I Can't Get Next to You.
Can't get next to you. true desire.
Before we say goodbye, something from the world of sports. The 52nd playing of the Super Bowl of American-style football played late Sunday, and the Philadelphia Eagles defeated the New England Patriots 41-33. It is Philadelphia's first Super Bowl win after two attempts. It lost to the Patriots in Super Bowl 39. That was quite a game back in 2005. By the way, this game had the most yards of offense, we understand, in Super Bowl history. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. Latest world news is straight ahead, and we hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Greg Burns, I'm Steve Norman. We're all in Washington wishing you a great Monday. Now back to Dennis Edwards and the Temptations.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Over the past 12 months, ISIS has lost the vast majority of its territory in Iraq and most of the towns it once held in Syria. However, the areas once occupied by ISIS must now be stabilized so the people who have been displaced by the war can safely return. As ISIS militants fled, they left behind explosive devices to hinder recovery efforts and kill returning civilians to dissuade others from returning home. The U.S. government and its partners on the ground continue to work at great personal risk to meet the immediate needs of Syrians and Iraqis. They are working to clear areas of these mines and other explosive hazards, as well as educating and warning families about the risks. In Syria, for example, coalition-supported explosive remnants of war efforts have led to the survey and clearance of over 90 priority sites, to include schools, over 20 in Raqqa City, health facilities, including the Tabqa and Raqqa hospitals, bridges and water plants, and allow for follow-on stabilization work to begin. Mine risk education is also underway across Raqqa Governorate, reaching over 30,000 beneficiaries, mostly children and young adults. Clearing the unprecedented amount of explosive hazards emplaced by ISIS is a monumental task, but one critical to the recovery of liberated areas. Refugees and internally displaced persons cannot safely return to communities contaminated with explosive remnants of war and improvised explosive devices until these deadly hazards are addressed. So far, the U.S. Department of State has allocated over $104 million to this effort, and U.S.-funded partners have cleared about 45 tons of explosive hazards in Iraq and over 1.4 million square meters in Syria. It has provided some $841 million of foreign military financing funding to Iraq, Jordan, and Lebanon for military equipment that will help these countries better control their borders, defend their national territories, counter violent extremist organizations, and increase operational training. Ensuring that ISIS is defeated remains an urgent priority and the United States' number one priority in the Middle East. The United States will continue to stand with the Iraqi people, the people of Syria, and our partners around the world in our shared fight against ISIS until it is defeated. There is still much work to do.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.